Welcome to the Basic Christianity Podcast, a college lecture series by ancient language and biblical scholar, Dr. Stanley D. Walters, presented by his student, Dr. Stanley D. Williams. The 33 lectures are found in Dr. Walters' fully illustrated book, Basic Christianity, Facts, Evidences, Reasons, available at ninevascrossing.com. Lecture 4, Getting Information About God. Is one idea as good as the next?
The idea that all religious ideas are equally good is not really very helpful. It's no more helpful to religion than the idea that all ideas about the natural world are equally helpful to science. Now, in spite of certain subjective aspects about the prospects of knowing the world around us, no one really doubts that we have a good idea about the world that is external to us, the physical world. For example, the scientist believes that his conclusions grow out of real contact with the physical world. He believes that the surface of the moon will support the weight of a man. This is based on photographs transmitted from a lunar satellite. Or he believes that fire burns more intensely in an atmosphere of pure oxygen than in ordinary air. And he knows why he believes this. Because he's in touch with the world, and that's the way it is. Besides this, science can correct itself. If perception were reality, as some philosophers say, then the scientist would never revise his theories. But researchers continue to improve and correct earlier conclusions, and sometimes they even reverse themselves altogether. This happened in nuclear physics, of all places, about 10 years ago, with regard to what is known as the parity theory. Now, I am saying that it doesn't make sense for us to say all ideas about the world around us are equally good, because we're in touch with the world, and we know that some ideas are true, and some ideas are false. Suppose, for example, there is a person who argues that an atmosphere of pure oxygen retards rather than speeds up combustion. Is this opinion just as good as the theory being advanced to explain the Apollo cremations? Surely not. Surely one of these theories is right and the other is wrong. Either oxygen speeds up or it retards combustion. It doesn't do both.
Footnote. On January 27, 1967, a little more than a year before this lecture, a flash fire swept through NASA's Apollo 1 command module, killing Virgil Gus Grissom, Ed White, and Roger Chaffee. They died when a suspected spark from a faulty wire ignited the pure oxygen environment inside the locked capsule. It would be 18 months of redesigns before NASA sent more men into space.
Now, is it any more sensible to argue that one religious idea is just as good as another? Is the idea, for example, that God is irascible and whimsical, snuffing out people's lives in unpredictable fits of anger, just as good as the idea that God is something like Jesus Christ? One idea may be more comfortable to live with, but I'm not talking about what is comforting. I'm talking about what is true. Do we care that our ideas about God and religion are true? Now, we surely ought to care about this, just as much as we care about our understanding of the physical world. In fact, we probably should care more. For if true, Christianity makes tremendous demands upon a person. Elton Trueblood has said in his book, Philosophy of Religion,
"Since religious claims involve a man's whole life, it is wholly reasonable for him to accept these claims or to reject these claims. but it is not reasonable for him to be indifferent to them. We should be foolish not to use all the intelligence we can muster in order to try to know whether Christianity is true. To fail to give our minds loyally to this inquiry would not be so much irreverent as stupid.
The point is, if the concept of God which Christians hold is true, then it makes demands upon a person, and we ought to care very much whether that concept is correct or not.
Personal experience.
Now, I'm sure that some of you will say that religion is personal. I experience it inwardly, and this takes it outside the class of scientific research. And I think this is true, that religion is personal. At least this is true to a degree. No one believes in Christian experience any more deeply than I do. I think the only ultimate reason I have for being a Christian is my personal experience of God. Through patient and prayerful Christian nurture in my home, I was taught early that one ought to open oneself to God. I did so, and I think that God responded to that openness while I was very young. He has done so repeatedly over the years. He still does so. I believe in Christian experience. It is an important part of the reason that I believe in God. Nevertheless, there are many things which give us inward impressions. I may be able to devote part of a lecture to this question of religious experience later in the semester. See Lecture 25. But it will suffice to say at this point that there have been people that claim that their experience of God led them to do very, very strange things indeed. Are we obliged to test even our inward intuitions so that we are not deceived by them? The newspaper tells of a man who abandoned his little boy on an island in the middle of the St. Lawrence River for the winter. With the boy was a middle-aged schoolteacher with two or three sacks of potatoes and I don't know what else. As it happened, the St. Lawrence River came up, washed the cabin away, washed the middle school teacher down the river. The little boy stayed alive only by getting on the roof of the cabin. After about 40 days, the Lord told the father to go back and pick up the two of them, only there was only one of them when he got there. Now, do you think that God really told that man to do that? He felt it in his soul. But if you say, no, God didn't, then somehow you have taken that man's inner impression and you've tested it by something. You've tested it by your concept of God. You said, my idea of God is that he wouldn't tell a man to do something like that. And if I had an inward impression that I should do something like that, I would think that I was being deceived, that it wasn't really God. The point is that even our inner impressions, the subjective experiences of religion, we somehow must test to make sure that they are not being deceived. Many things give a person inner impressions. What's more, nobody will ask that question, do you think that God really told that man to do that? So persistently as an unbeliever. You say, well, I believe in God. I believe in the resurrection of Christ because he lives within my heart. And the unbeliever will say, you're just being fooled, that's all. You feel something, all right, but it's not God. You've been psyched into this. A university professor, for example, in private correspondence, wrote to me once,
Sigmund Freud explained to us why so many otherwise rational people believe in gods. And with that psychological explanation in hand, I see no reason why Christianity should be given any consideration other than superstition.
That's a university teacher of philosophy. It is, in my judgment, a very naive statement philosophically, but that's what he says, and he gets away with it because that's the mood of our day. He is writing off, categorically, all religious experience. What way do we have of showing that our experiences are bona fide, if we are uncritical about them? My point is, can we afford to continue with religious beliefs which are unexamined and untested by what we know about God from sources outside ourselves? And this leads back to the question, where do we get information about God? How can I test my beliefs and my experiences so that they can be shown right or wrong? Just like beliefs about the external world must be tested, so beliefs about the unseen world must also be tested. Where do we get information about God?
Christian tradition.
The claim of the Christian faith is that God has revealed himself to men by assuming the form of a man and by appearing in a particular time and a particular place. By this means, he permitted man to observe him, watch his behavior, see him under pressure, and ask him controversial questions. Seen God around lately? But there was a time when he was around. The Word became flesh, says John, and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory. Now, this is an astounding claim. No other religion has ever made such a claim. No further revelation of deity seems to be possible than for God to come in person and let men see what he is like. Surely this is better than mere writings. Surely this is better than the testimony of prophets. Surely this is better than visions granted to a few men, that God should become a person, take his place in time and space, in the full light of history, and under the full observation of men who lived at the time. This idea is called the Incarnation, and it is the central idea of the Christian faith. This is not reincarnation, which is something altogether different. The Incarnation. God became a man in the person of Jesus of Nazareth. I always feel myself at a loss in trying to communicate the staggering and novel nature of this claim. Sometimes I ask myself, how can you tell a barber that this is so? When you go into the chair and you sit down and you say, did you hear about the Jewish rabbi that thought he was God? What's the punchline to that gag? He was right. Our question must be, is this claim true? If it is, we have in our knowledge of Jesus of Nazareth the fullest possible information about the character, the wishes, and the expectations of God. Now, in this sense, Christianity is a historical religion, as others are not. The essence of the Christian faith is the claim that certain events happened. We often identify the essence of the Christian faith with certain dogmas, which must be proved true, or with certain duties, which must be shown valid and justifiable. That is, if you try to explain to your friends, what is the essence of the Christian faith? You'll begin with certain doctrinal statements which you think you have to show are correct. Or you will begin with a handful of ethical regulations, and you think that if you can show those regulations valid, you will have vindicated the Christian faith to your friends. It is more simple than that, actually. Again, it's more simple than defending doctrines and creeds. All religions have those. The essence of Christianity is the statement that something happened. It may be difficult to defend a creed or dogma or a code of duties. What Christianity is concerned with is a series of alleged events, and the question must be, did they happen or not? This is our starting place.
Difference of other religions.
Now, Islam, of course, Mohammedism, is a historical religion in the sense that it originated at a certain time and place, and its founder really lived and died. And all religions, I guess, are historical in this sense. Their founder really lived, and they originated at a certain time and place. But this is not the kind of thing the Christian faith is saying. Islam does not claim that Muhammad was God in person. He was historical, but he was not God. The Christian faith claims that its founder was both historical and God. Later, I will present evidence that the incarnation was true. But for now, let me present a few perspectives that may help us to understand more fully the meaning of the incarnation. For example, G.K. Chesterton, the English literary critic and convert to Roman Catholicism, in his book The Everlasting Man, a little book that deserves to be better known among Protestants, talks for quite a while about comparative religions and the way that all religions have these myths and ideas about a great God who made the world. Men everywhere have always believed that there was what he calls a man who made the world. But no religious teacher ever claimed to be that man. Here's Chesterton's quote.
Not one of them had ever claimed to be anything of the sort. None of their sects or schools had ever claimed that they had claimed anything of the sort. The most that any religious prophet had ever said was that he was the true servant of such a being. The most that any visionary had ever said was that men might catch glimpses of that spiritual glory. The most that any primitive myth had said was that the Creator was present at the creation. But that the Creator was present in the detailed daily life of the Roman Empire, that is something utterly unlike anything else in nature. It is the one great, startling statement that man has made since he spoke his first articulate word instead of barking like a dog.
Does that mean no other prophet ever claimed to be God?
Yes. None ever in actual and specific recorded historical situations.
But all the writings of other religions claim to be the true religion, and they know how the world was created, and their gods created the world. There are all kinds of myths to that end.
Well, the idea is there. But whom do you know who ever turned up and claimed that it was he?
Where do they get the idea, then?
I think they get the idea because people always want to know what God is like. They would like to be visited by God, but no one's really said that it happened, at least not any historical verifiable situation.
Scientific discoveries.
Or consider from quite a different perspective, remarks made by the late Walter Terence Stace, who lived from 1886 to 1967. The emeritus professor of philosophy at Princeton, about the remoteness of God in our present day. Stace says these things in his book, Religion and the Modern Mind.
Logically, no doubt, it makes no difference. But psychologically, the difference is that it vastly increases the sense of God's remoteness. If the race of men is only a byproduct of natural laws set going millions of years ago, then even if God did create the natural laws, what can man be to God, or God to man? And if we push God back through astronomical eons to the beginning of a nebula which evolved into a solar system, those terrible gulfs of time which have elapsed since God made himself manifest in the world chill our minds and numb our hearts.
So his point is that modern scientific discoveries have pushed God back to the beginning of a long scientific process. And he cites the nebular hypothesis for the origin of the solar system eons and eons ago.
Footnote: First developed by Immanuel Kant in 1755, the nebular hypothesis is still the accepted model for explaining the formation of our solar system's sun and planets from coalescing nebulous material. The nebular hypothesis is not the Big Bang theory, which suggests how the universe first came into being from nothing.
Now, logically, this doesn't rule God out of the picture, of course. You still have to account for the nebula. You can always say, well, that may be the way the solar system originated, but who made the nebula? Could it possibly be God? How long has it been since God made himself manifest in the world? Was it as long ago and as far away as Stace suggests? I think not. The Christian doctrine of the Incarnation flies in the face against what Stace says. In fact, relatively recently, the last couple of thousand years, God has shown up. He has appeared to let men know what he is like. I also think that Stace's statement undervalues the ministry of the Holy Spirit to the believer, as far as manifesting God's presence, but that's quite another point altogether. Where is God, you see? If you ask Stace, he might reply with one of these graffitis which have been turning up lately.
God is not dead. He just doesn't want to get involved.
Do you begin to see just how profoundly unchristian that slick little statement is? God is not dead. He just doesn't want to get involved. What is the Incarnation if it wasn't involvement?
Greek and Oriental religions.
Or let me take another perspective. There is a fine illustration in the 14th chapter of Acts of the typical Oriental religion.
Footnote: the term Oriental that Dr. Walters uses here refers to geographic areas anywhere east of Europe. Thus, Italy and Rome, Greece and Palestine are historically known as the Orient.
The situation is this. Paul and Barnabas, his traveling companion, are at the Asia Minor city of Lystra. And there, after healing a man, the local populace has hailed them as gods in human form. They identify them and say, "Zeus and Hermes have come down to us in human form." Now, Paul and Barnabas were men enough to say, "Relax, folks, we're mortals just like you." And they talk to them about the essence of the true religion. The interesting thing at this point is that they gave to Barnabas the name of Zeus, and to Paul the name Hermes. Now, Paul was the leader of this evangelistic party, but it is Zeus that is the top god in the Greek pantheon, and we may wonder why they gave the name of the top dog to the man Barnabas, who was the assistant in the evangelistic party. Well, Acts tells us why they did this. It tells us that they called Barnabas Zeus and Paul they called Hermes because Paul did the talking. Now, the arrangement is something like this. Zeus inhabits the remoter recesses of Mount Olympus in lofty aloofness and splendor and would not condescend ever to communicate with men himself. If Zeus wanted to send messages to people, he has some flunky god there to do that kind of work for him. And Hermes is the guy. Hermes is the guy with the winged feet. That's Hermes. And he was the messenger deity. If the supreme god wanted to waft a message down to lowly mortals, an intermediary intervened and did the dirty work for him. The supreme god never got down there and got mixed up in people's affairs. This was Hermes' job. And so, when these people with their roots in Greek religion see Barnabas over there on the sidelines, standing there, arms folded, watching, and Paul out there slugging it out, doing the talking, they assumed the guy on the sidelines is their big one, see? And the guy out there doing the dirty work, you know, he's the flunky guy. Okay, now this is very interesting. And it poses a very striking contrast between the typical Greek religion, the typical Oriental religion, and the claims which the Christian faith is making. In the typical Oriental religion, the supreme deity remains remote and aloof, disengaged from people's affairs. How different is the Christian concept of God, where we find the deity with a basin and a towel washing the feet of his followers?
The Incarnation.
Once more, still a different kind of illustration. When the movie actor Charles Chaplin, who lived from 1889 to 1977, first came into success in this country, he made a pilgrimage from Hollywood to New York City. He came from England to Hollywood and had never been to New York City until he became a film star in the silent movies. The proprietor of a cafe frequented by Hollywood personalities in Santa Monica, Nat Goodwin, gave Chaplin advice before he departed for New York City, and this is what he said.
When you get to New York, keep off Broadway. Keep out of the public's eye. The mistake of many actors is that they want to be seen and admired. It only destroys the illusion. You'll be invited everywhere. Don't accept. Pick out one or two friends and be satisfied to imagine the rest. Many a great actor has made the mistake of accepting every social invitation. John Drew was an example. He was a great favorite with society, went to all their houses. But they would not go to his theater. They had had him in their drawing rooms.
And then, the cafe manager makes this very revealing statement.
Charles, you've captivated the world, and you can continue to do so if you stand outside it.
Now that's a very revealing statement, if only for what it reveals about the theatrical personality, with its aloof, detached, demanding outlook on life. But it's also a profoundly un-Christian statement. You've captivated the world and continue to do so if you stand outside it. When God sought to captivate the world, he made himself a part of it, in the most intimate way imaginable. He had no interest in keeping people from knowing what he was like. He wished them to know all that was possible for a man to know. And so daring, novel, absurd as it may seem, this is the claim made by the Christian faith. It is a saving claim, which offers man real knowledge of God and reconciliation to him. W. H. Auden says, quoting again from For the Time Being, a Christmas oratorio,
"Therefore, see without looking, hear without listening, breathe without asking. The inevitable is what will seem to happen to you purely by chance. The real is what will strike you as really absurd. Unless you are certain you are dreaming, it is certainly a dream of your own. Unless you exclaim, there must be some mistake, you must be mistaken."
Unless you exclaim, there must be some mistake, you must be mistaken. So says Auden, speaking of the incarnation of Christ. It seems impossible, and yet the Christian faith says this is real. Here is knowledge of God, which you can actually learn, master, and understand. Now, I very much wish that we could all understand this concept of the incarnation thoroughly. I don't think I understood it when I was in college. I don't know why that is. Nobody taught it to me, I guess. When I finally began to grasp what lay at the heart of the Christian faith, it made the Christian faith so lucid, so clear, so simple, so meaningful, so profound, that I wished I had learned it many years before. The incarnation, that God became a man in the person of Jesus Christ in order to show men himself and to reconcile them to him. It is this claim which we must investigate, and this leads us to ask, how do we know whether or not this really happened? And I want to, in the last few minutes of the period this morning, to introduce what will occupy us for about the next 3 weeks.
Factual evidence.
Now, of course, most of our information about this alleged incarnation comes to us in the New Testament. In particular, it comes to us in four short Greek writings, which we call the Gospels: Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. In a sense, then, our question is, how may we know whether or not what is told to us in those ancient writings is true? And this opens up for us certain questions about the trustworthiness of the Gospels, about their reliability. Now, it is, of course, possible to answer this question by saying, well, they are inspired by God, and of course, if they are inspired by God, they are true. Now, I happen to believe that, but that's not the kind of answer I'm going to be giving in the class. For one thing, that's the kind of answer that derives from a priori, it's self-evident, and not from evidences. I want us rather to make a rather patient and detailed survey that the reports given to us in the Gospels are trustworthy. And this is a different kind of answer. It doesn't mean that we refuse to say anything about inspiration. It just means that we want to answer it on the level of facts instead of the level of doctrines, if possible. We want to see that the Gospels are true, not because of a certain doctrine that we believe, but because the facts support the Gospel's trustworthiness. And therefore, the approach that we take during this course will be one which is almost exclusively factual. And you will, I think, be able to see how far the facts will carry us and where they will not carry us.
Four areas of uncertainty.
In particular, there are four leading areas of uncertainty about the trustworthiness of the Gospels, and we will address ourselves to each of these in turn in the coming lectures. First, I will begin by talking about the possibility that the stories in the Gospels were twisted by being told over and over again many times before being written down. We will begin to cover this topic in the next session, Lecture 5, by word of mouth. Secondly, I will talk about the probable sources of information used by the writers of the Gospels. If we can get our hands on where they got their information, we can evaluate whether the stories should be true. I will introduce this in Lecture 6, Source Criticism and the Synoptic Gospels. Now, before we cover the third and fourth areas of uncertainty, we will make two digressions, or three actually. We will first cover briefly the uniqueness of the fourth gospel, and then cover two important topics. The first being outside independent evidences for the gospel's authenticity, and the second on the whole subject of miracles. The third area of uncertainty, then, will bring us to Lectures 14 and 15 on text criticism, where I want to talk about some technical aspects of the study of the New Testament relating to the fact that, as far as we know, the original writings of the New Testament are gone. We do not have them. The fourth area of uncertainty is then about the choices that the early church made in picking the four Gospels and the 27 books of the New Testament out of a great group of early Christian writings which the church produced. Who says these 27 and no others? I will cover that in Lecture 16, The Canon of the New Testament. Now, each of these areas of study raises certain questions, and during the rest of the course, I will raise those questions for you and then explore with you the facts that help give us answers to these and many other questions. I hope that none of you will become uneasy by this. I know that sometimes it makes you very uneasy to find the Bible talked about in terms of questions raised. My own approach to this is that it's better to raise the questions here than to leave them for somebody else to raise when you're a long ways from anybody who has an answer. And so we will begin next time with the question, how can we know whether or not the stories in the New Testament are trustworthy? And that's all for this morning.
Thank you for listening to the Basic Christianity Podcast, a college lecture series by Dr. Stanley D. Walters, presented by his student, Dr. Stanley D. Williams. The 33 lectures are found in Dr. Walters' fully illustrated book, Basic Christianity, Facts, Evidences, Reasons, available at ninevascrossing.com. Thank you for listening.